Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Stay tuned to KQED for Here and Now in just a minute. Back to Elaine Leung at the traffic desk this morning as we find out about some traffic around San Francisco.
It's a crash that just occurred. Look out for this one. South 101 before Cesar Chavez. Three cars involved. One of the middle lanes is blocked. We've got traffic already slow from the 10180 split there. And North 101, we do have some stop and go starting at Paul Avenue to Hospital Curve. Bay Bridge, the bulk of the traffic from the incline across the span. And the West 80 approach slows starting at the Albany exit. Elaine Leung for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Xfinity with their Wi-Fi Boost Pod. In-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi offers coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. So very glad you're connected with us. Thanks for listening. You're on KQED FM 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI FM 89.3 North Highland, Sacramento. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman on Thursday, Here and Now at 11 o'clock.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
And I'm Asma Khalid. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the election interference case against former President Trump in Georgia is on hold yet again.
Also, a longtime asylum officer is critical of Biden's new immigration plan and calls for more resources to process people seeking asylum.
The government obviously needs to regulate the border, but it should never be done so in a way that places individuals seeking asylum at risk.
And Detroit's former train station, long vacant and crumbling, is reopening after a nearly billion-dollar renovation.
For a long time, this was a symbol of Detroit's decay. It stood out like the literal architectural sore thumb.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Boeing Starliner, carrying its very first human occupants, has made it to the International Space Station. The moment captured a short time ago by NASA Communications.
At 12:34 p.m. Central Time, above the southern Indian Ocean, we have confirmation of contact and capture of NASA's Boeing crew flight test and Starliner aboard the International Space Station. Butch and Sunny have made their arrival.
Veteran astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sunita Sunny Williams arrive, but not as smoothly as they might have wanted. The commercially built capsule missed its initial docking window due to thruster failures. NASA reported several thrusters on the Starliner service module failed as the craft pulled within several hundred meters of the ISS. Overnight, the capsule experienced several helium leaks, but they were deemed not critical to continuing the flight. Jurors in Hunter Biden's gun trial in Delaware heard testimony today from Hallie Biden, the widow of Hunter's late brother, Beau. She testified about finding and disposing of the Colt revolver at center of the case. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Hunter Biden and Hallie Biden had a romantic relationship after Beau Biden's death in 2015. On the stand, Hallie Biden told jurors that in October 2018, she found the gun in Hunter's truck at her house. She said she panicked, drove to a grocery store, and threw the gun away in a trash can where it was later discovered. Hunter Biden is charged with lying about his drug use when he bought the gun, as well as illegal possession of a firearm by a drug user. Hallie Biden testified that she frequently saw Hunter smoke crack and that he introduced her to the drug, something she said she was deeply ashamed of. On cross-examination, though, she acknowledged she did not observe him using drugs over the specific time period he owned the gun. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, outside the federal courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware.
A federal judge is ordering former Trump advisor Steve Bannon to report to prison July 1st. He was sentenced to 4 months for refusing to comply with a House subpoena. Israel's northern border with Lebanon has seen an uptick in violence in recent weeks as Israel exchanges fire with the militant group Hezbollah. Here's NPR's Hadil Shalchi.
Hezbollah and Israel have traded fire for months since the war started in Gaza. With tensions growing in recent weeks, a senior Israeli officer in charge of military operations on the border with Lebanon said Thursday that Israel was prepared and ready for a potential war there. In a speech marking the 18th anniversary of Israel's 2006 Lebanon war, Major General Ori Gordon said Israel would continue to fight, quote, until the task is completed of returning security to the north. A drone strike claimed by Hezbollah on a village in northern Israel killed an Israeli military reservist and wounded 11 people on Wednesday, according to Israeli officials. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Dow is up 33 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Residents of San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point have complained for years about the lack of local grocery stores. An unusual new market is hoping to fill some of that void. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara reports.
The District 10 Community Market looks like a small grocery store. Aisles of goods fill the middle of the room, with a wall of produce on one side and refrigerated items on the other. But unlike most grocery stores, the food here is free. Falole Holden heard about the free market through a Samoan senior citizens program she's part of. Several nonprofits in the city are partnering to refer qualifying low-income Bayview residents.
Oh, this is going to last me a whole month. It's just me and my mom, my daughter, my grandson. Yeah, so this is really good. It helps us out a lot.
The program is similar to a food bank, but shoppers here can pick and choose what they take.
You get the hamburger meat, you get drumettes, or you get wings.
That's Jacqueline Williams, one of the volunteers helping run the market.
Yeah, use your muscles to pull it open.
Williams says she likes volunteering here because she knows how much this means to residents who often have to leave the neighborhood to find healthy food at low prices.
They thank me, and I thank them, and then I joke with them, and I tell them, I'm going to charge you $5 or a dollar.
The market currently serves over 400 households, but they hope to raise that number to 1,500 within the next year. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at kqed.org.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And the listeners of KQED. Today, hot inland, otherwise expecting the beginning of a cooling trend today, mainly on the coastline, then cooling reaching further inland tomorrow through Sunday. Another potential hot period is in the forecast the middle of next week.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. The criminal election interference case against former President Trump in Georgia is on hold yet again. Trump was indicted last summer, accused of trying to overturn his election loss in Georgia. And the case was delayed earlier this year after revelations that the prosecutor, Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis, was romantically involved with a lawyer in the case.
The trial judge ruled that Willis could stay on the case, but former President Trump appealed that decision, and yesterday a three-judge panel at the Georgia Court of Appeals froze the case. Until, that is, they can take another look at whether Willis should be disqualified. That panel is made up of all Republican-appointed judges. And now to talk more about what this decision means, let's bring in Anthony Michael Kreiss. He's a constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor, the Georgia Court of Appeals could have taken this question up after a Trump trial or before. Was it surprising that they took this appeal up at this particular moment?
Well, I think yes and no. I think in some part there were people who didn't believe that the court would want to wade into this right now. It's a very busy court, and this would be quite an extra, heavy lift for them.
Mm-hmm.
But the real question for the court is whether there was an area of state law that was not clear and that requires some clarification. And the court seemed to think that was the case, and that's why they took the appeal when they did.
All right. So we mentioned that the judges who made this decision were appointed by Republicans. Was their decision unusual in any way? I mean, to you from a legal perspective, did it seem reasonable?
Well, it's pretty standard course. So there's this idea in the law called supersedious, which basically means that once an appeal is taken from a trial court, that the trial court loses jurisdiction to continue to hear and adjudicate that case. And so while Judge McAfee was trying, I think, his level best to continue to hear pretrial motions and to keep things moving along as this bigger question was being decided at the Georgia Court of Appeals, mm-hmm. the Georgia Court of Appeals yesterday stepped in and said, no, regular order should prevail. Things should be on pause until they can finally make a decision in this case.
And so presumably that means that there will be no trial before the 2024 election, which leads me to this broader political question, political slash legal question I would ask you, which is, if Donald Trump wins the election, if he returns to the White House, what would happen to this case?
Well, this case would continue against all the co-defendants who are not named Donald Trump. And so there would be likely a trial in 2025. It just would not be likely with Donald Trump on the other side of the table. That would have to be held in abeyance and basically put on pause until Donald Trump left the White House in 2029.
I see. And so then if he were to leave the White House, you're saying in 2029, does that mean that this case, that the trial for him would resume?
That's exactly correct. And so while the other co-defendants would have to go through their trial process, Donald Trump would have to answer for this indictment after he left office in 2029. So the case doesn't go away. It just would have an extended pause.
Does that pose, you know, particular challenges for Trump, though, being in office? Because it sounds like to some degree he has immunity while he is president of the United States.
Well, it certainly would give him some temporary relief, but it would, of course, remain a political cloud that would hang over his head. And I think that brings other kind of difficulties as well. And in particular, there are a lot of people in the United States who are afraid of Donald Trump having authoritarian impulses and not wanting to give up on power. And certainly those impulses or the impulse to perhaps seek political retribution against his political opponents would be enhanced if he felt that, you know, he had no other option but to seek out that kind of retribution or hold on to power, or he'd have to come back to Fulton County and face the real prospect of a very lengthy jail sentence. Mm-hmm.
There are a number of simultaneous trials that have been going on involving the former president. Can you remind us of the significance and importance of this Georgia case in particular against Donald Trump?
Yeah, there's two really important things that make Georgia stand out. I think, right, unlike perhaps the New York trial that had just revolved around Donald Trump's, the business records, and unlike perhaps the documents case in Florida, mm-hmm. This case, along with the Washington, D.C. case that was brought by Special Counsel Jack Smith, really speak to the heart of American democracy and the 2020 election and Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the election results in 2020. The other thing that's really important about Georgia, and it's very similar to the New York case, is that if Donald Trump wins election in November, he will be unable to dismiss this case against him or pardon himself, and basically relieve himself of any criminal culpability for the crimes that were alleged in Georgia. He can make the cases in the federal system go away by virtue of being president of the United States and the head of the federal government, but he cannot do that in state cases, and so that's why he ultimately would have to answer in Fulton County after he leaves the White House.
All right. Thank you so much, Anthony Michael Kreis, for helping us make sense of this all. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
With the president's executive order on immigration in effect, it's unclear how migration into the U.S. will be impacted. The measure partially shuts down the border when an average of 2,500 people per day try to cross without authorization. The processing of migrant asylum claims would stop and resume only when apprehension numbers drop. Some of the frontline responders, if you will, have questions about how it will work, including asylum officers. Michael Knowles is a longtime asylum officer and spokesperson for the Asylum Officers Union. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Deepa.
Michael, we know you're still reading through the details of this executive order, but it means that at a certain point, as I said, the processing of asylum claims stops. What's your biggest concern there about not hearing those claims?
Well, biggest concern of our members who are, by the way, highly trained in the area of refugee protection. Concern is that international and U.S. law provide fundamental human right of migrants to seek asylum. In fact, our law says, I'm paraphrasing, any alien, regardless of the time, manner of their entry or their status, has the right to apply for asylum. And our biggest concern is that these new rules would restrict significantly and even block the access of individuals to have their cases even heard.
And I want to ask you about practically what it is that your fellow officers do. Because when a migrant's detained at the border and says he or she is afraid to go back, an asylum officer gets involved and does what's called a credible fear interview. What does Biden's executive order do for this very first step, the credible fear interview? Will it still be conducted?
It will be conducted, but it will be conducted for very few people. If people try to cross the border during a period when it's closed, they just simply won't have access to the system. They may be summarily removed without any hearing. And those who do arrive during a low volume period will be able to have the interview, but under very restricted circumstances and applying a much higher evidentiary standard.
Got it. You know, Michael, people may not know that nowadays this screening that you're talking about, the credible fear interview, is virtual. Describe what happens in this screening.
So, Deepa, you would have an asylum applicant detained briefly in a Border Patrol station. They'd be on the phone with an asylum officer, the asylum officer somewhere else in the United States, an interpreter, sometimes an attorney in the rare case that the applicant was able to obtain one, and the objective being to determine whether the individual has a significant possibility of making an asylum claim in front of a judge or alternatively in front of an asylum officer in a more extensive interview farther in the process.
So a credible fear screening process comes first, yet of those found to have that fear who then go on to stake an asylum claim, only 30% actually win asylum. Why do so many fail?
Many asylum applicants actually don't meet the definition of refugee. Someone who has been persecuted in the past or has a well-founded fear of persecution in the future on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So it's pretty narrowly defined. Somebody fleeing a war or fleeing environmental disaster or a hurricane or a fire may have a good reason to flee, but that doesn't make them a refugee. Nevertheless, everyone has the right to have their case heard.
Michael, there are currently only 1,000 asylum officers who do these initial screenings. You know, just doing the simple math, if we're saying 2,500 people are arriving a day, 1,000 officers is not very many. The system we know is overwhelmed. You liken the work of asylum officers to triage. Why?
Well, the screening interview is designed to identify those people who need further treatment, need a further hearing, a full hearing of the merits of their asylum claim. And just in terms of asylum officers, we probably need 3,000 or 4,000 asylum officers. 1,000 is clearly not enough. Now, the government obviously needs to regulate the border, but it should never be done so in a way that places individuals seeking asylum at risk, and it should never be done so in a way that precludes them from even having their cases heard.
Michael Knowles is a longtime asylum officer and spokesperson for the Asylum Officers Union. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, Deepa.
It's Here and Now.
The D-Day invasion was 80 years ago today when Allied forces stormed the beaches of Nazi-occupied Normandy, France during World War II.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you.
Over the years, NPR interviewed D-Day veterans. Hear their stories on All Things Considered from NPR News.
The veteran stories and more on All Things Considered coming your way at 1 today, then on The World at 2.
An apartment complex in the small Gulf nation of Qatar, originally built for soccer players competing in the World Cup. These days, the place serves as temporary housing for hundreds of Palestinian refugees from the Gaza Strip.
And it will start from 5 a.m. for the breakfast.
We continue our series on survivors who've escaped the war in Gaza, next time on The World.
Join us for international stories this afternoon, 2 o'clock. Support for KQED comes from Berklee Repertory Theater, presenting Octavio Solis's Mother Road, an epic 21st century journey along Route 66, inspired by John Steinbeck. Playing through July 21st, more at berkleerep.org. Supermicro and NVIDIA accelerating AI with a wide range of AI servers and the NVIDIA AI Enterprise software platform. Supermicro is committed to driving AI infrastructure breakthroughs with rack-scale innovations.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com.
It's Here and Now. On this day, June 6th, 80 years ago, the United States, along with its allies, landed on the shores of northern France, an operation known as D-Day. It was a pivotal invasion that turned the tide in World War II, and today, President Biden commemorated the anniversary in Normandy.
It was a powerful illustration of how alliances, real alliances, make us stronger. A lesson that I pray we Americans never forget.
But really, the focus today was on the veterans who survived the battle that day and are still alive today. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith is in Normandy. She's been traveling with the president and joins us now. Tam, it is so great to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
So you were at this ceremony in Normandy to mark the anniversary. Describe for us, what did it feel like?
It was an incredibly moving ceremony, I think in part because there's a knowledge that these veterans are in their late 90s, their early 100s, they may not be here for another anniversary 5 years from now. And there was a real sense of that. People stood and clapped as the veterans were wheeled up to the stage. Almost all of them were in wheelchairs, except for a few who walked up proudly, and they got extra applause. Many had blankets on their laps and wore hats indicating which branch of the military they served in. And at various points, there were flyovers with very impressive military aircraft. And at the end, there was cannon fire that sent smoke streaming over the thousands of people who had gathered for this ceremony.
Mm. Did President Biden interact with some of the veterans who were there for the anniversary?
Yeah, so he did essentially a photo line before they went on stage, and he and the First Lady got to speak to all of them. At one point, one of the veterans told him that it was his birthday coming up, and so the president made everyone, including the press, sing happy birthday to the gentleman. and another man told the president, don't get old, as he settled back down into his wheelchair. And then later on stage, a number of the men were awarded the Legion of Honor Medal by France's president, Emmanuel Macron, and he would say their names and put the medal on their chests and give them a kiss on each side. And then President Biden would go up and whisper in their ear, shake their hands, touch their faces. It was a real tender moment.
Mm. So, Tam, what was Biden's message today during the ceremony?
His main message was that democracy is under a greater threat than it has been since World War II. Also, though, his message was simply to honor the men and women who were there on D-Day and in the days that followed, ultimately led to the liberation of Europe. And he also then tied that to America's alliances. And the lesson that was learned from World War II was isolationism doesn't work. America First was a slogan before World War II, and then America was pulled into that war. And so President Biden really called on Americans to remember that our alliances with other countries are our strength and pointed to the fact that Canadian and British troops were right there along with the Americans.
In listening to what you've been describing, it sounds like the subtext here is this other battle on the European continent that has been raging right now. And I'm thinking of Russia's war in Ukraine. How did the president speak about that conflict in his speech?
Well, he addressed it directly.
Ukraine has been invaded by a tyrant, bent on domination. Ukrainians are fighting with extraordinary courage, suffering great losses, but never backing down.
What he argued is that failing to defend Ukraine right now would be forgetting the lessons of World War II, that, you know, dictators and wannabe dictators are watching what happens and how America and the NATO alliance respond. And when he talked about the NATO alliance, it was a big applause line, which in the United States, it often isn't a big applause line. But here in France on this day, it was.
So, Tam, before I let you go, it sounds like this trip is obviously ceremonial, but it is nonetheless coming in the middle of Biden's re-election bid. So I have to ask you about the politics. How did presidential campaign politics come to bear there on this trip?
Well, they haven't really come to bear yet. This speech was quite focused on the veterans. Tomorrow, though, he's giving a speech in Pointe du Hoc near here, and he is expected to hit on the themes of freedom and democracy in a way that is more obviously related to his reelection campaign. Those are main themes in his campaign.
That's NPR's Tamara Keith. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And in Michigan, a former symbol of Detroit's decline could now be a new symbol of the city's rebirth. After 6 years and close to $1 billion, the city's historic train station is set to reopen today as an innovation hub anchored by the Ford Motor Company. The former train station had fallen into disrepair, abandoned for decades, until Ford provided the money to renovate it. It has been a major transformation, and here to tell us more, we are joined now by Quinn Kleinfeld. He's a host and senior editor at Detroit Public Radio. Hey there.
Hello.
So this train station, known as Michigan Central Station, became a symbol of what I would say is kind of urban decline, right? After it closed in 1988. What happened to this station?
Well, Detroit, they always say, is a city that put the world on wheels. And the more that the world got on wheels or started looking at air travel, the less it was looking at passenger train travel. And the train station, which actually opened in 1913 as the Michigan Central Station, despite its beauty, despite its numerous glamorous passengers it would go through, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, among others, people began to not use it like they used to. And because of that, it did sink into decay. By 1988, it had started to simply be abandoned. And it became, at that point, one more reminder that Detroit, according to some people, had seen its glorious days go and were gone. It's a massive structure, and it stuck out as a huge symbol of blight for the city.
So do you see the reopening as fitting into a sort of larger narrative about the city's rebirth or renewal? And I ask this because it's coming as census estimates say Detroit's population grew for the first time in decades.
For a long time, this was a symbol of Detroit's decay, many, many people would say. It stood out like the literal, you know, architectural sore thumb. It was such a change from what it had been. It had been so glamorous, marble floors, vaulted grand ceilings, beautiful chandeliers. All of that now, with the $1 billion almost that you mentioned before that Ford has put into it, has been reconnected. And because of that, it goes along with the narrative that the officials are saying, and the one that does actually seem to have a lot of truth to it. I mean, we're about a decade past Detroit filing the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. And the city has got lots of investment pouring back into it. And they really are trying to position the city as a destination for conventions, for tourists in general. And this is certainly going to be one of the things that they hope will be a draw.
Quinn, you were just describing marble floors, this just, you know, kind of beautiful, ornate. In fact, I saw pictures online, and it's really stunning. You've been inside, I believe, the renovated train station. How does it look? Can you paint a picture for us?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly open at the point that I had been in there yet to the general public. But you could see the work that had been done. I mean, it's being positioned as a high-tech hub to try to get autonomous cars and other research projects going for Ford as well as for other entities. But the work that was involved, it just stood out. I mean, they had to put in literally tens of thousands of new tiles for this grand hall. The basement, the entire bottom part of it was flooded. They had to pump out over 3.5 million gallons of water. All of that is, there's no trace anymore. I mean, it looks like a high-tech, very friendly environment that they believe will have people that not only want to take tours of it, but will use it as a very vibrant working space.
But I have to ask, what does this mean for the residents of Detroit, particularly those living in the neighborhood who've been around for the ups and downs here?
When you talk to some people there, it's become much more of a vibrant neighborhood. In fact, there are people who will say it's the most vibrant neighborhood in all of Detroit now. You talk to some people down there, they'll say, you know, that they don't feel gentrified in any way. They say that there are new people coming in. In fact, the only complaint I heard from one person was that some of these new people, they just like to listen to their headphones when they're walking around and kind of ignore you as you go by. So they don't say hi like they used to in the old days, but they seem like nice people.
So I am curious why Ford did this. You know, because it's hard to ignore the PR messaging here. And this is coming after, you know, thousands of auto workers went on strike, demanding higher wages at the big three auto companies last year. And this is, you know, it's a good PR message, presumably, for Ford.
It is. It's good for them. It's good. It's good PR for the city. And it's also a way to show that they are trying to give back to the community. As you say, I mean, these are huge corporations making, you know, huge profits. But the fact is that they do want to have a good showing of things. They're going to have a massive concert now, and they're going to be showing that nationally. So it's a way to not only showcase the Ford Motor Company, but to showcase Detroit, and in some ways, to showcase that whatever else has gone on, that they both seem to feel that they're still kind of joined at the hip.
So last question, will this old train station actually have trains coming back in at some point? Is it going to be a functioning train station?
Maybe. It might have. It's got the possibility. I mean, there certainly would be a station near Dearborn where Ford's main headquarters are that could ship workers back and forth to this. But nobody said a definitive answer yet.
All right. Quinn Kleinfelter, host and senior editor at Detroit Public Radio. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
It's Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. President Joe Biden has participated in ceremonies in France marking the 80th anniversary of the D-Day invasion that helped end World War II in Europe. Today he visited the American cemetery near the beaches of Normandy where more than 9,000 U.S. soldiers are buried. Biden said the largest amphibious assault in history was a reminder of the power of the alliances. Biden also called for solidarity with Ukraine, where the fight against the Russian invasion is in its third year. The president said that to surrender to bullies, to bow down to dictators, is simply unthinkable. The Southern Baptist Convention is preparing to vote on a proposed constitutional ban on churches with women pastors. The vote will take place at the annual meeting of the nation's largest Protestant denomination next week in Indianapolis. The denomination's statement of faith says the office of pastor is reserved for men. The Southern Baptist Convention can't tell its independent churches what to do, but it can expel them from the denomination. A toddler has been killed and his mother was injured when a tornado struck suburban Detroit without warning. Officials in Livonia, Michigan say the tornado tore through several neighborhoods yesterday afternoon and developed so quickly that there was no advance warning from the National Weather Service that would have normally led to the activation of warning sirens. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, still family-owned, operated, and argued over. Listeners can explore their brews wherever fine beverages are sold and learn how trailblazing runs in the family by visiting sierranevada.com. Sunny skies, cooler in the Bay Area, especially the coast and bay today compared to yesterday. Highs in the 60s, all the way up to the low 90s. Clear skies inland tonight, and then some coastal drivel, some cloud cover along the coast after midnight possibly. Sunny and cooler tomorrow with highs in the upper 50s to the low 90s far inland. Cooler still heading into the weekend.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at BetterHelp.com/public.
It's Here and Now. For 5 years, New York City has been preparing to charge drivers entering parts of Midtown and Lower Manhattan a $15 toll. Those fees would go toward improving mass transit. The cameras were installed. The new signs were ready to post. But with less than a month before it was set to go into effect, New York's governor halted the plan known as congestion pricing. From member station WNYC in New York, here's Stephen Nesson.
In a video announcement, Governor Kathy Hochul says now is not a good time, with inflation, to add another cost to people's lives. She says she's worried about how it could impact the ongoing post-pandemic recovery in Manhattan.
It puts a squeeze on the very people who make this city go. The teachers, first responders, small business workers, bodega owners.
Hochul says because of them, she's pausing the plan.
This decision is about doing what's right for the people who make our city thrive.
Other major cities, London, Singapore, and Stockholm, have congestion pricing that charges drivers a fee to enter the busiest parts of town. New York would have been the first in this country to try it. It was expected to reduce traffic and raise money for the city's transit agency, the MTA, $1 billion a year. That would go toward modernizing the ancient signal system, buying new train cars, and adding new elevators to stations. All of that is in jeopardy now. And for what? Fellow Democrats say it's purely political.
I get politics, I get elections, but leaders stand by policies that work.
That's New York Assemblymember Tony Simone speaking at the Capitol. He's a Democrat who represents parts of Manhattan. He knows the plan isn't well-liked outside the city, but says it was necessary to reduce the gridlock and bolster public transit.
Leaders take the brunt of the hit when things don't become popular.
But with several close congressional races in the Hudson Valley and on Long Island, where a loss to Democrats could flip the House, Hochul isn't taking any chances.
Keep your promise.
Even if it infuriates transit advocates in Manhattan.
Keep your promise. Keep your promise.
Keep your promise, several dozen supporters of the tolling program yelled outside Hochul's office in Midtown. They wave signs that read, "I heart congestion pricing," and "don't derail riders." City Council member Lincoln Ressler calls the governor's move a betrayal.
And do not believe what she is saying, that this is a delay. This is a plain and simple attempt to kill congestion pricing.
Transit leaders across the country were watching New York closely for inspiration. Now, it's unclear if other cities will be willing to try and reduce traffic in downtown districts through tolling, after seeing the potential political costs. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Nesson in New York.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, researchers and Indiana's Transportation Department are constructing a strip of highway that can charge the batteries of electric semi-trucks as they drive over it. Supporters say one day the project could transform how we charge our electric vehicles. You can hear that story wherever you are on your radio or your phone. It's Here and Now.
Healthcare in the U.S. is expensive and can be hard to navigate.
If you have had job-based coverage your whole life and suddenly you lose your job, you might not know where to go.
For our series, We the Voters, we discuss the health policies of President Biden and former President Trump. It's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Hear it tomorrow on KQED, and also you'll hear the California Report. It all begins tomorrow at 2 a.m. until 9. Support for KQED comes from TheaterWorks Silicon Valley and presenting Being Alive, a Sondheim celebration, a world premiere tribute to the composer of Into the Woods, Sweeney Todd, Company, and more. June 5th through the 30th in Mountain View, TheaterWorks.org. And Canyon Ranch Woodside, inviting groups and businesses to find their path to well-being at its retreat in the Redwoods. Canyon Ranch can help develop custom itineraries that tailor to every group's needs. More at CanyonRanch.com. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman. Thank you for listening. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51 AFL-CIO.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Road Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore. And ZSP Media, co-creator of HBO's The Jinx and WBUR Home of Last Scene, presenting a new podcast, Beyond All Repair, reinvestigating a cold case that will leave you questioning everything. Listen now.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. For many teenagers struggling with mental health issues, sometimes substance abuse can happen simultaneously. A national survey of teens done in 2022 found that those who experience a major depressive episode were more likely to have used drugs, smoked marijuana, or engage in binge drinking. It's one thing for an adult to use drugs or alcohol to help cope with the symptoms of mental illness, but what does that mean for teenagers whose brains are still developing? Let's bring in Dr. Peter Provet. He's an adolescent psychologist and president of Odyssey House, a sober living and addiction treatment center in New York City. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with alcohol. This national survey from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration found that teens who engage in binge drinking were more likely to have a depressive episode. Some people feel anxious the day after drinking, calling this feeling hangxiety. Tell us, though, what happens to a young teenager's brain when they binge drink.
This has been a consistent finding for many years. Kids who are using alcohol and marijuana are impacted by those substances in a variety of ways, particularly from an emotional standpoint. Their brains, as you mentioned, are in a developmental stage, particularly what's referred to as the frontal lobe, which involves thinking, it involves planning, it involves, to a degree, motivation. And so impulse control for sure. And usage impacts all of those critical functions in the developing adolescent.
And when we say adolescent, I was reading that the brain is not really fully developed until the age of 26. Is that correct? So we're talking about teenagers, but also young adults.
That's correct.
And now, let's go a little further, because we know that it is illegal to sell cannabis to teens, but a Columbia University study from last year found that 1 in 10 adolescents were using it casually. Is this different from alcohol that teens are accessing when we now factor in cannabis?
The most important variable here is the THC levels, which is the active chemical in marijuana that makes people high. the THC levels in marijuana have increased dramatically over the years, from something like 2% in the 1990s to well over 15%, 20% currently. Mm. So when kids are smoking marijuana today, it's not like your parents' marijuana, if you will, back into the 70s and 60s. It's a totally different drug, which increases all kinds of problems for kids. Their learning, their social isolation, low motivation, various types of brain impairment, as we refer to, in addition to psychosis and to some degree suicidality.
Well, that's kind of what we wanted to talk to you about, because that same Columbia University study also found that teens who use marijuana were more likely to develop these psychiatric disorders you just mentioned, suicidality, also depression, than those who never used it. What do we know so far about how marijuana triggers mental illness in teens?
The altered state that marijuana produces is, if you will, a symptom of underlying struggle. I don't think we can say directly it creates social isolation, directly it creates anhedonia, the lack of emotion, etc. Kids are vulnerable in their adolescent years to this range of sort of social phenomena. What marijuana use does is it increases those issues.
And Dr. Provitt, is this just like one-off use of, say, a teen who might be smoking here and there, or are we talking more of an addiction?
Right on target, Deepa. Marijuana is now understood as an addictive substance. The definition of addiction has changed over the years. Where it used to be defined by dependence and withdrawal, physical symptoms of a substance, today the definition is much broader. It has to do with how it impacts one's living, one's life, in creating, for instance, isolation, in creating depressed states. We now talk about marijuana addiction, where a kid in this case feels the need to use daily, and it impacts their social world. It disrupts their social functioning, and in that, we find now the definition of addiction.
So what signs do you look for? Because working as a kind of practicing adolescent psychologist who specializes in teen substance abuse, help us out here. What signs should we be looking for if we suspect or we know a teen is using, say, marijuana or alcohol?
One of the first things we do is talk to families who come to us at Odyssey House. We talk to the families about changes in behavior. Of course, the teen years, we see great change in the way children function. However, we try to key in to significant changes that are more abrupt, such as a kid all of a sudden losing interest in hobbies, a kid isolating suddenly much more, a kid having angry outbursts all of a sudden. Significant changes in behavior can alert the parent to potential drug use, and in this case, the use of marijuana.
Okay. And I wonder then, the next thing parents might be wondering is, you know, if we suspect this, it seems like access is so much easier these days with cell phones and social media. You know, a teen can find someone selling on Instagram, Snapchat. They can find out through social media which gas stations sell alcohol to teens. What's a parent to do? What advice do you have?
It's a very difficult issue. Obviously, monitoring their kids' activities is important. And having dialogue with children, that's what we always come down to in terms of general advice here.
And to teens directly who come, say, to you struggling with addiction, what resonates when you counsel them to scale back and to stop?
I'm always trying to help a teenager feel comfortable in their own skin. that's the biggest thing, to try to help a kid be comfortable in who they are, not overly susceptible also to social influence. We know for teenagers, being accepted in social groups is a key force, and that can lead to drug use when a kid gets involved with the wrong group.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard because quite often with a teenager, when you tell them not to do something, that's like a signal to go do it. And I'm wondering, you know, once the teen is on the path to getting better, what does recovery look like? What are the signs that, you know, they will stay the course and maybe not be susceptible again to, you know, to having a drink or a smoke?
Yeah, very important question. What treatment and recovery really should be, the best treatment and recovery, is helping the person find purpose in their life. Helping the person, in this case the teen, find reason to go forward in their life. Just stopping drugs is not the answer. The answer is yes, we want to help you stop substance use. However, at the same time, we want to help someone get excited about positive things in their life. Hobbies, sports, academic accomplishment. And we help children try to envision who they want to become as they get older.
Very sound advice. Dr. Peter Provitt is the president of Odyssey House, a sober living and addiction treatment center in New York City. Thank you, doctor.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Here and Now.
There's another hour of Here and Now ahead starting at noon on KQED, and coming up next hour, the San Francisco Opera, also known as SF Opera, is presenting the American debut of Innocence, an opera that explores how a school shooting continues to affect the families of victims and the shooter a decade later. More about it next hour on KQED on Here and Now. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi with Xfinity Gateway and X5 Pod that extends coverage to hard-to-reach areas. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. The most delicious party of the summer is back with Check Please, Bay Area's Taste and Sip at the San Francisco Design Center on June 10th, 7 p.m. Tickets at kqed.org/live, supported by Integrated Resources Group.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And TimberTech, transforming landfill-bound waste into sustainable PVC and composite outdoor decking products designed to look like real wood. More at TimberTech.com, everything wood should be.
It's Here and Now. The first commercial offshore wind farms in the United States are already producing energy along the Atlantic seaboard. Climate advocates say offshore wind is crucial for the country as it works to meet its clean energy goals. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports from the Jersey Shore, where more of these wind farms are yet to come.
A few miles from the boardwalk in Atlantic City is the Atlantic County Sewage Treatment Plant. It's not the most glamorous place for a clean energy tour, but it's here where Brandon Nearing is showing a group of environmental journalists what was once a cutting-edge wind turbine.
This is a GE 1.5 SLE turbine. This is a very old wind turbine.
It's one of five windmills installed in 2005 at the small wind farm Nearing runs at the plant. To the naked eye, the turbine blades turn slowly in the wind. But Nearing says it's moving quickly at the tip of its 120-foot blades.
Right around 100, 120 miles an hour at a tip. So it doesn't look like it's going very fast, but it's going pretty quick.
Still, that's nothing compared to what's coming. This small wind farm produces 8 megawatts, enough to power roughly 4,000 homes. Compare that to the 700,000 homes that would be powered by the Atlantic Shores offshore wind farm planned nearby. The project is a joint venture between Shell and a renewables company. Doug Copeland with Atlantic Shores is also on the tour. He says its windmills, which will be built in the water 10 to 20 miles offshore, would dwarf the ones we're looking at today in Atlantic City.
These, I think, are about 380 feet tall, is what you said. Ours will cap out around 1,000 feet tall.
That's as tall as three football fields. Copeland says these huge windmills will sit on what's called a monopile. Essentially, it's a huge steel tube.
We'll be using a monopile foundation, which goes into the seafloor. It looks like a very big steel straw.
The boats needed to carry these parts are so big they can't even fit beneath bridges. So New Jersey is building a special port near the ocean just for the offshore wind industry.
Hi, folks. Hopefully you can hear us. We don't have a bullhorn.
About an hour from Atlantic City is the home of the future New Jersey wind port. Right now, it looks like a huge gravel parking lot. Once built, it will have spaces for manufacturing and storing blades and other components. Construction manager William Dixon says it'll be big enough for companies in this industry to transport the blades, towers, and other parts needed for a wind farm. And these parts are big.
The components for offshore wind are so large they can't go over the road or by rail. So, yeah.
Dan Fatten, who manages the offshore wind program with the New Jersey Economic Development Authority, which owns the port, says his agency is spending $600 million to build it. Companies that use the port to build projects off the coast of New Jersey and surrounding states will pay rent. At full operation, the port is expected to employ 1,500 people. Fatten thinks it will be a catalyst for the industry.
This is, I think, a national treasure. When we think about creating offshore wind projects off the coast of the Atlantic Ocean.
Climate argument for offshore wind is pretty straightforward, says Chris Olith, director of the Special Initiative on Offshore Wind, a nonprofit funded by philanthropies.
Except for offshore wind, there are no other renewable energy opportunities for the Mid-Atlantic or the Northeast.
The East Coast is power hungry, and the Mid-Atlantic grid that includes Pennsylvania and several Midwestern states is currently dominated by fossil fuels, the main cause of climate change.
We don't have a good profile for solar, and we don't have enough land for solar or land-based wind, so offshore wind is our only deployable shovel-ready answer right now.
But it won't be easy. Several big projects have recently been canceled because of high interest rates, inflation, and supply chain problems. There's also been a wave of misinformation associating offshore wind with whale deaths, some of which has been spread by groups linked to the fossil fuel industry. These reports have been debunked by scientists. But there are also concerns about how offshore wind will impact the fishing industry and tourism. The net effect is approval for offshore wind is down, especially for Republicans. And while President Biden is a wind supporter, former President Trump, his likely opponent in November, is against it. Olith says, despite all this, offshore wind still has immense possibilities.
From a technical perspective, we can power the entire country, the entire East Coast, the entire nation with offshore wind power. There's enough energy above the ocean with wind to do that. There's questions of what's economically feasible and et cetera, but it's absolutely possible to do.
Atlantic Shores could install its first wind project by the end of the decade, and more are slated to follow. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
And stay with us. Another story that we are covering today is the U.S. debut of the opera Innocence, which explores the impact of a school shooting on an entire community 10 years after it happened. You can listen to that story on your local public radio station or at ahereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. Thanks for listening to us and your local NPR station today. Give your local NPR station some love. They're the heartbeat of all our communities. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Landmark College in Vermont.
offering summer programs for high school and college students to help discover their learning abilities and help achieve academic and social success. In-person and online options. More at landmark.edu/summer.
Oh yes, we will take your public radio love right here anytime. This weekend, KQED Arts, a Latin music festival in San Jose, what to watch on TV this summer, and an Oakland sneaker shop returns, but with a twist. Find those stories and more at kqed.org/arts. Get ready for the next update. It's just a tap away with live news streaming anytime.